accession number 32297, rear 8.
John Dixon, rear 8. John, you were just saying about how you would walk out to the Harvard and do your pre-flight checks.
That's it. Well, it's quite a normal, in today's terms, they call it a walk round. I don't think we ever use that expression, walk round, but basically all you're doing is making sure that nothing's hanging off, that all the panels are screwed tight, that are meant to be screwed tight. You check that the flaps, that the, sorry, not the flaps, the ailerons and the rudder and the elevator all move. You do this with your hands just to make sure everything is working like that. Check that the tyres looks okay. And that there's nothing fouling the intake where the propeller goes. So that really is it. And then you climb in and do your cockpit checks once you're settled inside.
And what are they when you sit with the cockpit?
Yeah. Well, obviously you run round the cockpit just to make quite certain that everything is there. Well, the first thing, of course, I always used to check was how much fuel have you got, because you do need to make sure that you're not going to run dry in the middle of everything. So check the fuel, check the control column, move it all round, make sure everything is moving in the right direction. I always used to like to check the elevator trim particularly, in that I used to wind it right back, because on a normal aeroplane like this, I'm not talking about tricycle undercarriage, one of these sort of aeroplanes with two main wheels and a tail wheel, you need to keep the tail down. And the first thing you're always taught, or one of the first things, is when the engine is running and you're on the ground, keep the control column right back so that the tail wheel is always firmly on the ground. It didn't happen once with me, but I might have to talk about that later.
So once you've done your checks, again, this relationship you have with your instructor, are you given, in the early days, do you make the checks and does he sort of supervise you doing that, or watch what you're doing?
Yes, in the initial pack, when you do your checks, you talk to him, you say, I'm doing this, doing that, and anything that you're moving, he can see or feel in the back. If the controls are moving, he would know that. But you tell him that, and then when you've got competent in it, he doesn't check you, if he just says, right, done your checks, and you say, yes, sir. And that's it. But at first, when you're learning, he wants to make quite certain you haven't forgotten anything.
Starting up, how do you get the aircraft to start up? Because you mentioned how you started up the Tiger Moth. How would you do that with the Harvard?
Well, it had a, I think they called it an inertia starter. It was a Pratt & Whitney engine, a good American radial engine. I think it was about 500 or 600 horsepower, which was sounds little these days, but having come from a Tiger Moth, it was a big aeroplane. And it had, between the rudder controls, there was a pedal, like an accelerator pedal in a car. And when you'd switched everything on and got the fuel switched on and made sure everything was clear, nobody was standing in the way, you put your heel on this pedal, and that started the inertia going, and the engine started to wind round. You could hear it wind, and the pitch of the noise would sort of wind up, you know, as you wind something, and you'd instinctively know when it got to a level. Then you press your foot forward, so you press the accelerator forward, this accelerator pedal, and the thing burst into life. You hoped. With clouds of blue smoke, and oh, it was great. And the noise. Yeah.
And how would you then taxi the aircraft?
You have to taxi in a zigzag fashion, because the nose of the aircraft is sort of raised up, because you're sitting on a tailwheel aeroplane. So you can't see directly ahead. So you're taught as you taxi out that you zigzag from side to side, just to make sure that there's nobody in front of you. And that comes to my next story, if you want to hear it now. Later on, I might be jumping ahead a bit. We had snow and ice because we were flying in Canada from September right through till Christmas time. And I suppose it would have been November, December, and we had snow and ice, and I was flying solo, and I taxied out, and I did everything absolutely correctly, and I was getting round towards the point where you would stop to do your pre-takeoff checks, and there was another aeroplane, another Harvard, parked with its tail facing into the middle of the airfield, with its nose pointing towards the taxi track, and he'd been doing his checks like that, and I was coming along to go past him. And I swear to this day that the chap in it, it was another pupil, just did not look. He did not look. It's like you going out of a T-junction in a car without looking to your right. And he did not look, and he started to move out in front of me. So, panic, of course. I jammed the brakes on, which you are done with your feet, toe brakes, throttled back, but the taxiway was very icy. So I was sliding across this ice, absolute panic. But fortunately, before I hit him, I ran onto a patch of ground which was not so frozen. So the brakes bit, but unfortunately my speed was such that the brakes stopped, but the tail came up, and there I was standing on my nose. And I swear to this day that it was not my fault. This chap had taxied out in front of me. I didn't unfortunately get the number of his aeroplane, but I could have described it, because being a senior course, it had a checkered pattern on its nose. So he was one of the senior course. Anyway, I was on the carpet naturally, and I explained all this, but they took no notice, and I got a red endorsement in my logbook, which was something that frightened you a bit at that stage, because you didn't want that sort of thing in case they decided you weren't going to make the grade. But I still think to this day I was hard done by.
Initially, though, with the first part of the training, with the Harvard, where does the instructor sit in relation to the pupil?
In the Harvard, the pupil always sat in the front, and the instructor in the back seat. He had a slightly limited set of instruments, but he had the basic instruments. I mean, he could fly the plane perfectly well from the back seat, and of course they were all highly experienced pilots. It always used to worry me that if they were landing from the back seat, how could they possibly see? But they could see enough looking out of the side, I suppose, or whatever. But they were very well skilled pilots, so we never had any worries.
And how did the sequence of instruction occur with the Harvard, as opposed to obviously with the Tiger Moth? What was the first things that you did with your instructor?
Well, it was really, you still basically followed the same sort of program. You had to learn to control the aeroplane, you had to learn how to cope with a spin, and you had to learn how to cope with a stall, you had to learn the emergency procedures. Everything was laid out to a pattern. It was very basic, and then you flew with your instructor circuits and bumps, which was just to get you into the routine of taking off and landing. Quite normal.
Did that differ in a Harvard, though, from a Tiger Moth, with it having more power, or is it just simply the same process for taking off?
I don't quite know how to answer this. Obviously it was different, because I mean you had got a much more powerful aeroplane. You'd got other things to think about. I mean you'd got your undercarriage to raise and lower. You'd got flaps that you needed to lower when you were coming into land. You had the pitch control, which I've described before, which had to be in fully fine pitch when you were taking off and landing. So those were the things, and of course you had to learn different speeds, the speed that you are going to bring it in at, and the speed on the approach, all that sort of thing.
So it's the same process, but you're having to think of an awful lot more.
Oh, yeah, an awful lot more, yes. An awful, it was, well, I suppose, I don't know how to describe it, a bit different, a bit like driving a Mini and a Maserati or something. That's an exaggeration, but it was different. But we quickly learnt it. I mean, a few trips and you were felt quite confident.
With the undercarriage, how did you operate the undercarriage from the aircraft?
Oh, well, there was a lever, obviously, somewhere on the sort of like the dashboard, a lever that just raised up and down. It must have had a little safety gate on it somewhere so that you couldn't inadvertently catch something on it and lift it when you were on the ground. But it was just a normal lever with a knob on the end of it, as far as I remember. And in any aeroplane, when you raise the undercarriage, having taken off, you instinctively dab the brakes shut, jab on the brake to stop the wheel spinning, so that when the wheels go back up into their housing, they're not spinning round. Wouldn't have done any harm if you'd forgotten that, but it was just a little point.
And obviously, coming into land, is there some kind of warning that you would have if you'd forgotten to put the
wheel down? Oh, yes, yes. You know more about it than I do. Well said. Yes, when you throttle back with the undercarriage up, a horn will blow and will be quite raucous in your ears, and it's a bit nerve-wracking. But the idea being that if you were coming into land and you'd forgotten to put your undercarriage down, and this did happen, several people have done it, this horn would alert you to the fact that you'd forgotten something. Going on from that, of course, when you got to the point of doing aerobatics and spins and stalls and all that sort of thing, you didn't want this thing blaring in your ear every time you throttled back. So there was an override switch that you could turn the horn off. Trouble was, of course, having done that while you were practicing, you didn't put it back on again. Lots of things to remember.
And when you were flying with your instructor, I take it he would take you through to sort of familiarise you with the aircraft. Was there much more then of your being on your own to practice things at a much earlier stage than it had been, obviously, with the time?
Yes, I think so. I believe, and I can't truthfully say I remember this, there was some sort of rule that because of our experience, presumably on the Tiger Moss or whatever flying we'd done, that you should be able to master the Harvard in, I think, six and a half hours dual instruction, and you should be able to go solo on Harvard within that period. Okay, if you didn't, it wasn't the end of the world. You had a little bit more extra intuition and maybe a switch to a different instructor. But it was expected that you would go solo within 6.5 hours, something like that.
Was it the same procedure for soloing as it had been with the Tiger Moth, or is it just a stage where the instructor will say, well, you can go now?
No, just the same. I mean, he would give you probably fly a couple of circuits with him, with him in the back, and he just to make sure that you on this particular day you weren't asleep or hungover or something dreadful. And when he felt confident that you were in control, he would just tell you to go off and just do one circuit. That's all, one circuit and landing, and then come back to him. And then he would probably climb back in and you go and do another exercise, or he might say, well, that's it for the day, you've done it. There was no, you know, you didn't have to do everything all at once. But, of course, like everything else, once you'd gone solo, you really felt top of the world, didn't you? And you worried if your mates had gone solo and you hadn't.
Prior to soloing, I take it you would have had to have done spinning again.
Yes.
Does that differ in a Harvard than a Tiger Moth?
Oh yes, very very much so, because it's got a, it. Well, you wouldn't say it was a vicious aeroplane. It was by no means a vicious aeroplane, but everything happened very quickly. If you throttled back to stall the aircraft or spin it, once it reached the stall speed, it would drop a wing very quickly, and it would sort of flick. So you've got to be prepared for that. And I'm trying to remember, did it always drop the same wing? And I don't think it did. May have just depended on the whichever aeroplane you were flying. But as you took the power off, held the nose up, the speed fell back, and when it got to stalling speed, something would happen very quickly, and you had to be prepared for it. So I won't say it was violent, but it was... you had to be a bit on your toes.
So it was a bit more immediate, a bit more powerful an experience than with the Tiger Moth.
Oh yes, yeah. But the same routine, Hammond. If you got anything into a spin, the same routine for getting out. The spin was presumably you were spinning to your left. Let's say you were spinning to the left. So at a crucial point, you neutralise the control column, centralise it, you bang on hard opposite rudder, so you push on hard right rudder, and eventually the spin would stop, so you'd be diving straight, and then you just pull the stick back, open the throttle, and hopefully all would be well.
How about stalling in it? Is it the same?
Well, it's basically what I've just said. You stall the aeroplane, and it would just probably drop a wing. So you've just got to let the nose come down to build up the speed and lift the wing up, and all fairly straightforward.
Were you introduced to other things here? I'm thinking of maybe things like formation flying, flying on instruments again, but with more...
Yeah, well, I've just sort of recalled how this program of training worked. It was a 16-week course altogether, divided into two lots of 8 weeks. And when you were in the first 8 weeks, that was called the initial training squadron, and you were doing the basic things that we've just been talking about. I'm just trying to remember. I think it is possible that we may have done just a little bit of night flying in that first 8 weeks, but let's pass on from that. You move on to the second 8 weeks, when you become the advanced training unit or squadron, whatever we called ourselves, and you then were the top boys on the course. You know, you've got a junior course coming behind you, so you were the bee's knees, because you'd done the... And when you were in the senior squadron, then you started doing formation flying, you started firing guns, where you didn't fire the guns immediately. You used a camera guns. You used bombs, little practice bombs, 11.5-pound practice bombs for bombing targets. You certainly did night flying. And the other thing that happened in the advanced squadron, we started using radio. There was a radio set. It was called a TR-9. I don't know why I remember that, but it was a TR-9, and it was a highly efficient set, and with that you had a microphone that was built into your oxygen mask, which you clipped across your your face, and you had earphones built into your helmet, and you plugged you plugged a lead into a socket, which was normally just underneath your seat. And you could talk to the outside world, you could talk to your instructor. You had a little button on your microphone in front of your nose, which you kept switched off, because once you switched it on, of course you were going to get a bit of background noise. So you kept this switched off until you wanted to talk either to your instructor or to the outside world, and then you click this on. And if you were going to broadcast to the outside world, there was a button that you pressed. I can't truthfully remember whether that was on the control column or separate, but there was a button that you, a transmitter. Otherwise, if you didn't press that, you just talked to your instructor in the back.
And with the communication, were you taught to keep it brief and to the point?
Oh, yes. Everything had to be brief. Roger and over and out and Wilco and all these wonderful things. It always tickles me when I watch films of war films now, and it's all completely nonsense when they say, "Hello, Roger. This is Tree Toad. Over to you," and all this. Well, you didn't have any of that. Well, we didn't. Everything was very brief, and in my very latest days of flying, right, it was almost you didn't expect a reply. You just called the base, gave your aircraft recognition number, and passed any quick message and shut off. There was, you just didn't drag it all out. But in those days, some people, rather like I am now, liking the sound of their own voice, would yakker on.
Would you have to ask for permission to take off from the control tower?
When you had this radio, yes, because that was all part of the drill. You asked permission to taxi out, you did your pre-flight checks, and when you were ready to roll, you just called up and said ready to take off, and they gave you permission.
Would that be the same for landing as well, that you would require permission to land?
Presumably, yes. Can't quite remember how we dealt with it in the Harvards, but in later days, of course, you just... I'm jumping ahead many years now. I mean, you'd approach the airfield, you call the airfield, give them your number, and you'd just say visual. In other words, you could see the airfield, landing instructions, and they'd give you which runway to use. They'd give you the altimeter setting, your barometric pressure, got it right, so that you could set your altimeter, and they would then say you're clear to land, or you're number two to land, or whatever, and that was it. And then you would report that you were downwind on your final approach, then at the end, as you turned in, you would call up and say 206, 3 green, which basically meant that you've got 3 green lights indicating that your undercarriage was down and locked, and you just call finals 3 green, and that was it. But out in Canada on the harbours, I don't know that we went to those lengths. You probably just let them know that you were there, and they would have told you if you shouldn't land for any reason. And also, of course, this applied all throughout training. Somebody would fire off a red signal, red very light signal, and if you saw one of these floating about, you pushed off a bit quick, because it meant there was a problem.
You mentioned various aspects of the advanced training that you did. Can we take them in order? But firstly, night flying. How did that differ from the night flying that you'd done in the UK?
Well, in some instances, it could have been easier, of course, because out there, there was no blackout. So the towns were lit. I don't remember that the roads were particularly lit or anything like that. But what we did, and this is quite interesting, we were based at Kingston, Ontario, but there was a satellite airfield which was about, I don't know, probably 20 miles away, called Gananoque. And all the night flying tended to be done from Gananoque. And at one stage in our advanced training, we moved over there as a course. You moved over there and you lived there for 10 days, probably, something like that. And you just concentrated on night flying. It was interesting, but Gananoque was a dead and alive place. There was nothing there. There was just the aerodrome and a mess hall and a I don't know whether we had a nappy or something, but I remember when we were there, it was very, very cold and snowy and icy, and I mean, often you didn't even go outside. You just sort of stayed indoors all the time. But we got through it.
With the night flying, because obviously you described what it was like in the UK, though, was the airfield illuminated?
I don't think it had any more than we had in the UK. I seem to remember they just had these gooseneck flares, which lined up a runway. The other thing I can't be truthful about, and I don't remember this too much, but when it snowed out there, and it used to get quite heavy snowfall, what they did, they didn't come and scrape it all away so that you could fly. They sent out huge heavy rollers and they went all over the airfield and they compressed the snow really hard, so that it just became like a level playing field, I suppose, and you just treated it like an ordinary grass field. You could taxi anywhere you like. You didn't have to stay on taxi tracks. The runways, you weren't actually on a physical runway. They just lined a runway up according to the wind direction, and you just flew on and off the snow. It sounds quite frightening at the moment, but I don't remember that we ever had any problem with it.
Flying at night, again, would you just do a circuit of the back to the airfield, or would you go further afield?
Well, initially, of course, I mean, it was the same routine. You had your instructor with you, you flew several circuits. I assume we had this same sort of landing scope that told you whether you were too high or too low, and you just stuck to the circuit. You didn't go too far away, and then eventually, of course, you were allowed to go solo, and you did that. You didn't go away from the circuit, and then depending on the your advanced state of flying, how you were doing, you would eventually be allowed to leave the circuit and go off and do sort of cross country flying, which basically meant flying from one town to another, looking for the lights.
Did that make it easier, obviously, though, at that stage, that these towns weren't in blackout and that you could use them to navigate?
I suppose it did, yes, really. Yeah, I don't know quite how we identified the town. Well, we knew from a map, of course, where everything was, but it was fairly relaxed, I think.
You also mentioned gunnery.
Yes.
And initially doing it with a camera. Again, could you take me through how you were trained in that?
Well, it never really worked. The idea was that everybody had to learn how to shoot something else down when you were in the air. So the Harvards, not all of them, but some of them were actually fitted up with machine guns. I don't know, probably only one. I truthfully can't remember how many machine guns there were, but presumably only one. But long before you did that, they just loaded you up with film, and you took off, and I think initially that there was a target aircraft which may well have just been a mate of yours. He was flying in another Harvard, and you made a pass at him, you know, a quarter attack, which meant sort of coming round and attacking him from the starboard rear or whatever, and lining up your gun sight, because you had a sight, and pressing a button, and the film would record whether you had him in your sights or not. And we did three or four of these exercises. I don't truthfully remember that the films ever came out. They didn't seem terribly reliable at all. And then having done that,